Hi, I'm John Rawling, welcoming you to Ringside Rewind, where I'm joined by Tris Dixon and Ian Dark. And we're grateful for the sponsorship from Fleet UK, a car and commercial vehicle leasing company based in Hampshire who are supporting our podcast. Great people who've supplied customers for 20 years or more, including me. Wherever you are, they'll find and supply any vehicle you want and work out financing options to best suit your needs. Fleet UK pride themselves on transparency, trust and fairness in every deal, and you can take it from me, they are brilliant at what they do. Check them out at fleetuk.com.
Hello and welcome back to Ringside Rewind with Ian Dark, John Rawling and me, Tris Dixon. Gents, it's a pleasure as always, and we are talking today about, we're at cross purposes, we're talking about Chris Eubank and about Nigel Benn. So obviously we've done our sort of looks at the careers of several high profile fighters, but we want to look at these guys partly because, incredibly, it looks like their sons could be fighting in the near future. But John, I'll kick off with you. Chris Eubank, Nigel Benn, I mean, did you know that they would always be on a collision course with their, not just their fighting styles, but their demeanours and their characters and everything else?
Well, it was a long time coming in the run-up, wasn't it? I mean, ITV got behind the two fighters, and Eubank in particular used every possible opportunity to goad Nigel Benn, saying that he'd got the skill set, that he'd got the punch, he'd got everything, and basically he was coming for him. Nigel Benn had already captured public imagination hugely with his spectacular, exciting fighting style. And, you know, great fighters are often born out of great rivalries. And however good you regard Eubank and Benn individually, together that rivalry was something special. And even over 30 years on now since it was building, it still reverberates to this day.
Ian, how about you? I mean, the first time you saw Chris Eubank, what did you think you were looking at?
He was great copy, wasn't he, for the journalists? He was just a natural star. You thought, who is this guy? He can't really be a professional boxer, can he, the way he carries on? Is this all just an act? Well, it wasn't an act. We all grew to really like it and love him, I think, especially the journalists like Colin Hart, absolutely loved Chris Eubank. And, you know, and Benn was just so exciting, so explosive, so much fire and brimstone every time he got in the ring. It was all action. And they were like, you know, they were just two stars who were set on a collision course, weren't they? I mean, it had to happen, and it was great that it happened, that they met when they were just at that stage where they were young and full of the business, and the result was spectacular, of course, the fight, the first fight.
I don't know that we'll ever get the answer to this, Ian, but let me ask you anyway. You say it was we learned it wasn't an act, but is it an act? Because obviously he's still doing it now. Is this what we see with Chris Eubank Senior now? Is this a great facade? And has he tricked us all?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I used to ask myself that question, but I can tell you about. So I used to go down to Brighton or Hove. He insisted, didn't he? And he had two houses next to each other. And he used to fly a guy down from Manchester to cut his hair in one of the houses. I said, what, you fly him down? He said, yes, only one man can do it. And then another time I got there and he said, you're going to have to wait because I've got to go and get changed. I said, it's just like a TV interview. Chris, you look fine. We can do it now. No, he had to go and get changed and have the cane and the monocle and everything and the strange tweed jacket before he would do the interview. And he insisted. He said, we're going to do this with me at the end of the table and you at the other. And this long table about 20 yards apart. So it had special microphones that I could hardly hear what he was saying. But, I mean, it was crazy, really. But it could not have acted that. But I tell you what, beneath all that kind of posing and posturing and everything like that, he really did have a huge fighting heart.
Yeah, of course.
I remember around that time going to a photographer's on Oxford Street to have some you know, sad little publicity photograph taken back in the radio days when I was working for BBC Radio. And I went down there, had my picture taken, and there were various photographs of, on the wall of people who had their shots done in this place. And there was Chris Eubank. And I said to the guy who took my photograph, oh, that's Eubank. You know, I know him. I've interviewed him and cover his fights. And he said, oh, yeah. He said he let me have his photograph, but he only let me have it on one condition. And that was that he was displayed on the wall next to Terry Thomas. And Terry Thomas, of course, had this persona whereby he was the upper crust toff who sort of talked like that, very, very. And actually, he was an East End guy. He came from a tough background. And I think Chris identified himself with him.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, I think there could be a question of just lines being blurred with the Eubank thing and him living the part. I just don't know. It's something that's been going on for so long now that I don't know. I think the thing is, people have warmed to it, though, haven't they, Ian? Do you think? I mean, people were cynical and it was a bit love to hate, but now I think people think he's interesting, and also he's had this sort of second coming with Gogglebox, where he's been on with his boy and talking about stupendous confectionery and that sort of stuff, and a sort of younger generation of appreciating his quirky ways when perhaps we weren't quite so on board in the early 90s. Is that fair?
Yeah, that's right. I think, you know, like a lot of fighters, good fighters, yeah, people tuned in, I think, to see him put in his place, put on the seat of his pants. You're right. But then everybody did grow to love him. And, you know, I think we're getting a bit out of sequence here, but one of the fights I think that made everybody love him was when he went to Germany and fought Graziano Roccagiani. You know, and the whole crowd were baying for his blood, but he went through all the routine he did at home, you know, tapping the gloves, you know, and looking out at them before the fight, just standing on the ring apron, fronting them all up, and then going on to, you know, win everybody over with probably the performance of his career. So, you know, that was the kind of thing that made you love him. And I think that, you know, the first Ben fight made everybody thought, hey, look, this guy is really serious for all this act. They thought it was an act, maybe. I never thought it was, but they grew to love him. I mean, I think he was great at press conferences. I remember that some guy, I can't remember who the opponent was, and he came with this pathetic poem about what was going to happen in the fight. So he ran out. It was something like, you know, it went something like, in round one, I'll be the one. In round two, I'll be better than you. In three, I'll break free. And in four, I'll put you on the floor. And then there was a big silence in the room. And somebody, one of the journalists, said, what do you think of that, Chris? And he goes, not exactly Shakespeare, was it?
Oh, jeez. And then, so... John, on the flip side of this, you had Nigel Benn, who was this surly character who, you know, is now a granddad and you know, a guy who's very invested in his son Connor's future, and living every fight through him or with him vicariously, in a supportive role. But back then, he was quite a mean dude, wasn't he? And I don't know if you ever felt you got on the wrong side of Nigel Benn, but a few people did, didn't they?
He was difficult. He was intimidating. But like Eubank, you know, Ian talked about Eubank being great copy. So was Nigel Benn. And he'd got a man called Ambrose Mendy alongside him, who was pretty shameless in some of the things he came up with to get Nigel Benn's name in the papers. So I remember going along to one press conference, and Ambrose comes out with this line, oh, I've insured Nigel's fists for 10 million quid. And of course it was total absolute bull, but the reporters didn't care. They wrote it all down, and there it is next morning in the papers: Nigel Benn's fists insured for 10 million quid. You know, and that's the sort of scheme that Ambrose came up with. But yeah, he could be very difficult. He'd turn up late for press conferences. And anybody who chose to question why he was late, you know, they get the sharp end of his tongue. And I remember once having to literally run down the street following him because I'd been sent along to get an interview and to get Nigel Benn on the radio Sport News. And he was just refusing to do it. And I just sort of ran after us and after him, and eventually he turned and he just said, "You're not going away, are you?" I said, "No, I just want to talk to you for 90 seconds about this fight." And eventually he turned around and did it. I never had a real problem with Nigel. He was okay, but some of the newspaper boys, they found him very, very difficult.
Yeah, he was surly. You're right, it was annoying how late he was for press conferences. It was like he didn't have any respect for what our job was, because, you know, the guys were working to deadlines. We all had other things we had to do that day. He wasn't the only interview in town. So, yeah, he was bad then. But, you know, he had a chip on his shoulder. He was arrogant. He was surly. I remember another one of those Ambrose Mendy press conferences, John, where I can't remember what fight it was. And they sort of like the tagline for the fight was "a wolf in sheep's clothing." Yeah. And we all looked at each other and thought, "What is that? What are they talking about here?" So Ambrose Mendy had to explain it to us and said, "Well, it's, you know, it's the way Nigel dresses, isn't it?" I said, "What?" He said, "You know, sometimes he's got that sort of coat that looks like a sheep." Does he?
It's reaching for that.
Peter Moss said, "You don't expect us to write this, do you?" From Peter Moss from the Daily Mail. Said, "You don't expect us to write this stuff, do you?" He said, "It's ridiculous." And then Ben got involved and it all got pretty angry about, you know, because his mate Ambrose Mendy was being criticised. But yeah, I mean, it was all quite confrontational, but it kind of fitted his ring persona, didn't it?
And the great British public, I remember, they at that time, they hadn't really hooked on to Chris Eubank. And a lot of people, as you said a little bit earlier, were really hoping that he went in there and shut this guy up. I think the great British boxing public were really hoping that Ben, in that first fight, was going to go out there and knock Chris Eubank out. He was the popular favourite, unquestionably.
Hey, one more thing before we get to that first fight. I remember reading years after the event about Ambrose and the Black Pack, which was, do you remember that? And who was in that? Apparently it was Nigel Benn, Linford Christie, was it maybe Martin Afire, the rugby league player? But it was a group of athletes that Ambrose had assembled. And I think they obviously had this kind of anti-establishment ethos. And obviously the thing with Ambrose as well, and I'll just buy you guys a little bit more time if you're struggling to recall this, but obviously the thing with Ambrose was he wasn't ever licensed by the British Boxing Board of Control, and so he was on board as an advisor, wasn't he? And I think it was seen as he was a renegade, right? Ambrose was a renegade. He was doing his own thing, but also he was a manager without a manager's license, in essence. I think, is that fair, John?
Yeah, I think it was. He was somebody who just lived by the gift of the gab, and people latched onto him, Nigel Benn being one of them, because he was outwardly very smooth looking. He was a very snappy dresser. He looked flash, and he was somebody who was proud to be black, proud to be fronting this group of athletes, and I think they, at the time, wanted to latch onto him because they perceived a kind of a glamour. Whether or not that was genuine is sort of open to discussion. And some of the things that happened thereafter would suggest that that was not the case. But at the time, he was certainly very flash, and Nigel Benn wanted to be a part of this.
And going into that first fight, so when Eubank fought Benn back in 1990 in Birmingham, that first one, Benn was coming off the back of an outstanding win over Iron Barkley in Vegas. And I don't know, I mean, which way were you guys going ahead of the first fight? Do you remember? I know we're pushing 32 years now. So, Ian, do you remember who you were picking ahead of Eubank, Benn won?
I don't, honestly, if I'm being brutally honest at this point. I mean, I thought it was pretty much an even Steven kind of fight. But do you remember that fight? Part of our thinking was Ben had that fight with Anthony Logan, wasn't it?
Yes.
I think it was at Albert Hall, where he was on the floor and looked open. He charged in and got caught. And you just wonder whether he might be just too wild and get down on the counter. I remember that Logan fight, he turned it around with the most extraordinary punch. He seemed to come up from the canvas to put Logan on the floor. I just thought it was a classic matchup at the time. I mean, both of them had the nation talking. They had the boxing fans entranced. The build-up was incredible with all the verbal crossfire that went on. There was a real sense of expectation about this. It was going out, as John said, peak time on ITV. I did the fight for BBC Radio, Radio 2, as it then was, not 5 Live, as it is now. And it was just a really explosive atmosphere at the NEC in Birmingham.
Eubank was kind of untested, though, wasn't he? Ben had got the WBO title, although back in those days, the WBO title, it has to be said, was pretty lightly regarded. He'd won that by beating Doug DeWitt, and he got that great win against Cyron Barkley, as you say. But Eubank, you know, he came into it on the back of a string of wins against not very big names, in all honesty. He got people like Johnny Melfer and Kid Milo there, and he came into the back of it on that one round knockout of a guy from South American called, Reginaldo dos Santos. And those weren't exactly household names. So Eubank was very much untested. And I don't know do you remember when they actually signed for the fight? They did the contract live on an ITV evening program. And Eubank and Ben, along with Barry Hearn and Ambrose Mendy, were all seated together with Nick Owen. And Eubank sat with his back to Ben, who was looking at Eubank, the back of Eubank's head, with complete loathing in his eyes. You know, you could see that he was just raging against Eubank, who refused to turn around and face him. And eventually, live on air, they signed for the fight. But there was just this palpable hatred, particularly on the part of Ben. I think Eubank said, "Look, it's just business. I don't hate him." But Ben most definitely did massively dislike Chris Eubank.
And that, Ian, that was because obviously we started off talking about Eubank's identity, and obviously Ben was saying that Eubank was a fraud, basically, and he wasn't what he was putting out. He wasn't what he was saying he was.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I think he hated the whole Eubank shtick. I mean, they couldn't have been two more contrasting characters, could they? You know, Ben had been in the army. He was a hard man. He'd served in Northern Ireland, went in the ring and blew people away. As John said, he'd already got a world title of sorts. I was at that fight when he beat Doug DeWitt in America. So, you know, looking back, thinking, and I suppose that did make him a kind of narrow favorite for the fight, because, yeah, Eubank's opponents hadn't been out of the very, very top draw, and Ben had been to America and scored a win for a WBO title. So there was that. Yeah, I mean, it was the ultimate grudge match. Often it's phony ballyhoo, isn't it? A lot of the talk that goes on before fights to sell the tickets. But you didn't need any phony ballyhoo for this one, because it was all pretty real, particularly on Ben's part.
And John, obviously, we've sort of, you alluded to the Nick Owen show there. I mean, how big was this fight? Fight one, you know, on terrestrial TV, newspaper coverage, TV coverage, and all the rest of it, in comparison to anything that we get today.
Well, it was absolutely colossal. You know, we're talking here about a time before social media, and we're talking about a time pretty much before satellite television. The big player in town was ITV, and both fighters had been built on national television and had been mouthing off about each other after their fights on national television, on ITV, with Reg Guttridge doing the commentary, Jim Rosenthal presenting, and these guys had been given an enormous platform right into every household in the country. So, yeah, I mean, you get fights that which are huge now, like the AJ fights and the Fury fights, but I don't think they gripped the country, the whole country, in the manner that this one did. And newspapers were a very different thing in those days. I mean, newspapers have declined alarmingly in the last 10, 20 years, but in those days, fights were built out of newspapers, and you'd go along there. I mean, I can still remember the name of every reporter on each newspaper 30-odd years on. They were big names, and somebody like Colin Hart was absolutely the leader of the pack as the main man in the sun. So you'd get your press conference sitting down there, and the first question inevitably would come from Colin, who'd kick it off and pretty much determine the direction in which the news of the day, the press conference of the day, was going to go. That's right, isn't it, Ian?
Yeah, and there was, yeah, I can remember them all now, Hugh McIlvenny, Sidney Hulls from the Daily Express, Peter Moss from the Daily Mail, yeah.
Alan Hubbard, yes.
All those guys, and it was very big news.
Could it have done somewhere bigger than the NEC in Birmingham? And should it have, the first one?
I can't remember. What was the capacity at the NEC in Birmingham?
It was about 12,000.
Yeah. Yes, of course it could. I think it could. It's always hard to kind of project yourself back to 1990, the different landscape then. But I think, if put it this way, if everybody knew what the fight was going to be like, they could have sold that 10 times over. I mean, it was good, wasn't it? I think it's in anybody's top five, say, domestic scraps.
John, we talked about previously about Ricky Hatton and the Blue Moon entrance. Where does the Chris Eubanks Simply the Best entrance rank for you in terms of, you know, the all-time experiences in terms of atmospheres and that kind of stuff, and the mixed reaction that it brought, right?
Well, I cannot hear that Tina Turner song now without instantly thinking of the fights and about Chris Eubanks' walk-on. And he just got it to a T, hadn't he? It was one of the great ring entrances. When Simply the Best struck up, he'd get up there onto the ring, and eventually, after taking seemingly forever, he'd be up there on the ring apron, tapping his gloves, staring into the crowd, goading the crowd as much as anybody else, living the moment, being the showman, and then he'd flick his way, do the somersault over the ropes into the ring, and he was ready to go. As I think Reg once said after he'd done it, the ego has landed.
Yeah, it's one of Reg's great lines, wasn't it? That, yeah, brilliant, brilliant line. I mean, I remember hearing Barry Hearn say to Chris Eubank, because they knew this was part of the spectacular that they were putting on every time Chris went to the ring. And I remember him saying to him, make sure you give it the full Monty, Chris. You know, I mean, he didn't need any persuasion to go out and do all the things John just described. But the crowd kind of loved it. You said it, Tris. Some of them were hoping he'd get beaten, you know. They hated it all, but it was one hell of an entrance. I mean, you said one of the best ring entrances. I think it is the best.
Yeah, they
very quickly, Barry and Chris, bought into the old showman ethos. You know, it doesn't matter what the news is. It doesn't matter whether you like me or you hate me. Just remember me. Get my name right. Remember the name Chris Eubank. And they bought into that, and, you know, and they laughed all the way to the bank, didn't they? And with the rivalry with Nigel, you know, it was just fantastic for the pair of them.
Well, and I suppose the Simply the Best thing galled Nigel all the more, given the fact that Nigel was the world champion going into the fight and Chris was, you know, comparatively untested. Yet here he was coming into Simply the Best. I can imagine Nigel absolutely seething. And he was, like, when you look at them staring across the ring at each other, it was one of those great, you know, regardless of which fight, but you could see the disdain on Ben's face. He couldn't mask it at all, could he?
I mean, you think really with Nigel Benn, you remember we all said, you know, Mike Tyson had a lot of opponents beaten before the first bell, but you really wouldn't want Nigel Benn looking at you across a ring with his eyes burning into you in the way that Benn used to look across the ring. But of course, Eubank was not intimidated by anything. So that was going to work with him. He was just as up for it too.
And I think it's interesting with this, John, this particular fight, this first one, obviously, I've mentioned there, obviously, that Eubank was comparatively untested. But as that fight started to unfold and he took some of Ben's big shots, we started to realize that this is a guy who's far more than a monocle and a cane. But this is actually a very, very hard man, right?
Oh, yeah. We knew that he'd got a fantastic chin when it started to unfold. It was a fight fought at a brutal pace and fought with savage intensity. I remember in the fourth round, well, we were told afterwards in the fourth round that Eubank had bitten right through his tongue. He'd been hit so hard that he bit through his tongue. And he didn't actually tell anybody at the time because he was worried that had anybody known and had they got a doctor in there and somebody to look at it that had said, hey, this can't go on. Yeah. But he was prepared to go through that sort of pain and that sort of brutal attack, which Ben unleashed on him, because Ben really threw everything at him in those early rounds.
Yeah. I mean, do you remember? I remember you coming out in the first round with kind of, sort of almost walking sideways and straight away throwing a right hand at Ben, like a little statement, almost trying to catch him cold. But that incident in the fourth round where he bit through his tongue, I think he was swallowing a whole lot of blood, wasn't he?
Yeah, I mean, it was one of those which was just, you couldn't take your eyes off the action. You mentioned Linford Christie earlier. I remember Linford was sitting in the corner with me. I think I presented that fight, or I may have been there as the ringside reporter. I'm not sure which, but Linford, who I knew from the athletics world, and indeed Ian did, we knew him pretty well. He was sitting there right by my side, and he was just open mouth, slack jawed in admiration, maybe horror to a degree. Just the sheer intensity of what was going on just a few feet away from him in the ring.
Yeah, and there was a kind of fever pitch atmosphere, I remember.
Oh, that pitch.
As well. You could feel that as well, as these huge punches were exchanged between the two of them, and neither of them seemingly really establishing a sort of big control of the fight. You know, there'd be a bit of ebb and flow about it, but with some great punches were landed, and everybody knew, I think, from quite an early stage, hang on a minute, this is a bit of a classic we're witnessing here.
And I suppose we have touched upon the form guide, but 18 months earlier, actually, Ben had lost to Michael Watson, and so obviously I suppose there were still some questions about, you know, how he'd fare in a longer fight, and a fight where he didn't have things all his own way, I suppose, Ian.
Yeah, I mean, and that fight against Michael Watson, it was in that tent, wasn't it, at Finsbury Park. I remember going there that night. I mean, Watson was absolutely magnificent that night, and he drew Ben Sting. There was almost something of the old Ali rope-a-dope with Foreman about it. He let Ben unload, covered up on the ropes, just catching him with brilliant counters as well, Watson, and he kind of waited for Ben to punch himself out and took him out, you know, with a jab as it happened, and it didn't take much more than that. So that, yeah, there was that little question mark too about whether Ben had enough craft about him, whether he was just a big explosive hitter and something of a one-trick pony. So yeah, there was another little question mark going into the fight about what Ben really had, whether he was the full article at that stage.
Yeah, of course. And then, John, so during the fight, well, in terms of towards the end of the fight, which was stopped in the ninth, Eubank put Ben down in the eighth. The scores going into that final round were two lots of 76-75 in I think Ben's favor, and then a 75-76 in Eubank's favor, but there was nothing between them, a hair between them both. And then obviously Eubank breaks through and scores a famous win. I mean, it was vindication, validation, and everything that Eubank could have wanted, and the respect that he'd craved, I guess.
Well, yeah, you articulated it quite beautifully there. Nigel's eye started to go. I seem to remember around about the fourth or fifth round, his eye started to swell up really alarmingly. And when you looked at the two men in the ring, you could see that Nigel had taken the greater punishment. You know, he was pitching, he was giving it absolutely everything as long as he was in there. But when Chris found the punch which finished it in that ninth round, you know, I mean, I can still remember the look on his face, just the sheer delight, vindication of everything that he stood for and everything that he'd said. And the same way, Nigel was there on the canvas and then back in the corner as the beaten man. But I do also remember that, you know, despite all the animosity and the bad words in the run-up to the fight, Nigel was pretty big in defeat, and he gave credit where it was due. And I seem to remember that he was very, very open, saying, yeah, I've lost today, the show goes on, I'll move on from here. But today, on this day, I was beaten by the better man.
Yeah,
so the line from Nigel that I've got here is, whatever I may think of Chris Eubank, I have nothing but respect for the way he worked tonight. Little did we know that they still would despise each other 30-odd years on. I suppose in part despise. I mean, I think there's obviously a lot of mutual respect and understanding there. I think they probably hate each other's shtick, as Ian said, but they've gone well beyond that. Ian, there's that famous image of Eubank, fists together, looking up into the air, and he's not acting there, is he? He's relieved, he's delighted, he's thrilled, and he's just pleased the whole thing's come to an end, right? And he's the winner. You remember that famous image of him after, you know, basking in the glory of that victory when Richard Steele intervenes and protects Ben from any more punishment.
Yeah, I think it was 5 seconds, wasn't it, from the end of the ninth round that Richard Steele, yeah, it was that big a fight that they got Richard Steele over from Las Vegas to referee it as well. That was all part of the show as well. But yeah, I mean, you said it, Tris, it was vindication for Eubank. This big, big build up, this huge grudge between them, and he's the man who proved himself the better man on the night. And of course, one huge plaudits. I think everybody looked at Chris Eubank in a much different way after he'd done that in that fight. I seem to remember Gary Newbon doing the interviews, wasn't he, for ITV? Didn't he say to Nigel Benn in the interview afterwards, I mean, he got a great one with Eubank where he proposed to Karen. Do you remember that? Marry me, yeah. Karen. But I think he said, he asked Benn something like, did it hurt? And Ben said, of course it fucking did.
Oh, geez. Yeah, well, what can you say? Where can you go with that? John, do you think that did you speak to Nigel at all in the aftermath of that? Do you know how badly that loss hurt him?
He got back on his horse, didn't he? Pretty quickly, he was back in the ring and rebuilding his image. He came back with a fight at Your Call, didn't he, against Robbie Sims, who was Marvin Hagler's relation, and he came
half
back,
brother, yeah.
Yeah, I remember being there that night, and it was absolutely rammed the place. You know, they could have clearly put it on in a much bigger venue than Your Call, but the place was absolutely bursting at the seams. And Nigel did a job, and it was very clear that he was, yeah, it must have hurt him, but he moved on. He believed that was just another hiccup in his career. He'd beaten Michael Watson, as Ian told you, and he'd come back from that. And he still had that self-belief, I believe, and he was still burning with the desire somewhere down the road to give it another go against Eubank and to prove that he really could be the better man. And I think he still believed that.
You touched on quite an interesting aspect, I think, there, John, because sometimes I think when a fight is so great, both fighters' reputations go through the roof. Obviously, Eubank was the big winner, but I think in a way, it had been such a classic that it only put up Nigel Benn's marquee value and the interest in him even more to see whether he'd bounce back from that. He was still that wild explosive, devastating guy. So you still wanted to watch him. So it was by no means the end. As John said, he quickly kind of plotted a path back.
I don't know what the television audience was for that big fight at the NEC, but I would imagine it must have been pushing on into the high teens of millions. And the pair of them had kind of crossed over the divide between boxing and sports. The pair of them had become completely household names. And we both remember going to press conferences and interviews after that. And you know, Eubank press conference had been staged in the Dorchester Hotel, and he bought this very, very flash Aston Martin, which he used to turn up in. And the whole of Park Lane used to stop and gawp at Eubank when he came in. They were huge stars, the pair of them, particularly Eubank, who'd moved on to a whole new level as a result of that victory.
You mentioned the Aston Martin there. There's that great story, isn't there, about Chris Eubank staying at the Dorchester, and he was going to be flying to New York. So he was going to sort of leave the suite empty at the Dorchester while he went away for a week. And when the Aston Martin was delivered, it was like at 5 a.m. in the morning when he bought it. So he went out for a spin in Hyde Park, and
as you do,
befriended this vagrant in Hyde Park, stopped the Aston Martin, said, you know, get in the car, we'll have a ride round. Took the vagrant back to the Dorchester, left him in the suite for the week, ordered a whole set of new clothes for him, and told everybody at the Dorchester to look after him at the suite, and ended up buying him a flat in Brighton or something. It's an amazing story. It's all in the book about Eubank. But I mean, that was the kind of crazy character that he was, the kind of thing he got up to. I mean, he spent a fortune. I mean, someone else told me that, you know, he used to stop the driver and say, can we just stop here? And he'd go in and buy a, you know, a suit for about £3,000 or £4,000, you know, just on spec.
Sounds like an afternoon with John Rawling.
He does.
I wish. the money we're talking about there, though, was absolutely huge. They were earning pretty much getting on for seven-figure sums then, you know, 30-odd years ago. So think what that adds up to now. They were earning hugely, and particularly in Eubank's case, he was ready to spend a lot if he could.
Well, and it's funny, you talked about Nigel going back to business and him beating Robbie Sims in 4 months. Eubank was back 3 months later, so they were earning regularly as well. And you'll remember, both of you, that he came back and fought Dan Sherry, and that was the fight with the reverse headbutt.
Oh, yeah.
And I think you remember that, Ian. I see that's brought a smile to your face. I mean, what a way to go from being a hero who'd beaten Nigel Benn to a guy who was trying to sneak a back headbutt on Dan Sherry.
Yeah, I mean, when you think a lot of Eubank's fights, you wondered how well he'd got down to the weight or prepared for them. There were many of those where people said, we didn't really do much in the fight. Did he do enough even to win it? So, yeah, I mean, it was a strange career in a way. I mean, he had that thing with Sky, the Sky Sports deal for the World Tour. Do you remember the World Tour?
Yes.
Started in London, and we used to go, I think we were in Belfast. I said, you know, we better have our jabs for this World Tour. We never went anywhere much with it. And the fights were, I think they're like the publicity line that came out from Sky at the time was, you know, Chris is going to be defending his title 8 times a year. You're going to see him all the time. Everybody's going to make a mint. But it was a bit of a damp squib. It was a kind of marketing man's dream. But yeah, it was a world tour that hardly got beyond the English Channel.
I used to love the relationship which he had with his trainer, Ronnie Davis. They were just an amazing couple. Ronnie was a big personality in his own right. Yeah. And they had a very, very close relationship. But Ronnie once told me that Chris would think nothing of ringing him at 3 o'clock in the morning. Something would be bothering him. And he wouldn't say, morning, Ronnie, you know, can I just ask you, it would be, David. And he'd be picking the phone up at 3 o'clock in the morning and sort of speaking to him as though he was his servant.
Didn't he used to call him Porter? He called him Porter.
Porter, that's right.
I mean, he was, you're right. I mean, he was great, wasn't he, Ronnie? Yeah. I mean, the other Eubanks story, excuse me, was, do you remember they had a stage of the Tour de France down on Brighton seafront?
Yeah.
You
know? Yeah.
And there were all these crowds out, and Eubank actually thought that they'd all turned out to see him training. You know, he was riding along on his bike, and he didn't understand it was for the cycling.
That's brilliant. Hey, so after that Dan Sherry fight for Eubank came the two Michael Watson fights. Obviously, the second one was tragic and changed the course of British boxing in many ways. Were you both at the second Watson fight?
Yeah, we were sitting side by side, weren't we? And it was, you know, just harrowing. It was one of those nights which you wish hadn't happened. But as you say, it changed boxing, and it certainly changed Chris Eubank. After the Watson fight, he was never the same man again. You know, again and again, you would see him in fights thereafter get an opponent into trouble, and he'd back off, and you could see that he didn't want to inflict damage, because whatever you say about the bravery of Chris Eubank, he's also a very emotional man, and I think it was a long time before people realised that was the case. But he didn't want to go where he'd been against Michael Watson. He didn't want that in his career, in his life ever again. Because even now, when you talk to him about that, Chris will come close to breaking down. He remembers that night.
Yeah, I mean, it was such a sad night. Eubank always used to say, boxing is a barbaric business. Do you remember that? He said, yeah, if you're a fighter and you say you love boxing, you're either an idiot or a fool. So that was his kind of view publicly about it all. But that night, I mean, I thought Watson shaded the first fight. I thought he was hard done by in the first fight between them. And then the second one, he was just brilliant for most of the fight. He had an intensity Eubank just couldn't match. And then, of course, you know, what happened right at the end of the fight, and the way, there was something horrible about it. I remember John Morris, who was the secretary of the British Boxing Board of Control, saying to me as they carried Watson out of the ring, he was saying, you know, we're pretty sure he's recovering, he's exhausted. I said, no, I said, John, it's not that, it's worse than that. Because we'd recently covered a fight in San Antonio where a guy called Kid Akeem had a blood clot on the brain and was carried out. It just had the same look and feel to it to me. I mean, we were so close, weren't we, John, to it?
Yeah.
It was frightening. You really did fear for him, and of course it turned out to be, well, nearly as bad as we feared. I mean, honestly, I did wonder whether he would live even then, as it was happening in front of us. So it was a terrible end to the evening, and you know, thank goodness that Michael's made a recovery of sorts as well as he has over the years.
And it's ironic, really, when we talk about the two different personalities and mindsets of Ben and Eubank, that they've both been touched by similar tragedies and affected in similar ways, really, as well. Maybe personally rather than professionally, but obviously a couple of years on, Nigel had his fateful fight with Gerald McClellan, and I'm sure we'll come into these fights in longer form down the line. But like you said, John, I mean, or Ian, I think it was more to do with, I think you can't really talk to Nigel without him tearing up now about the McClellan fight.
Well, I was involved in that big benefit night at the Grosvenor House Hotel that they did for Gerald McClellan, and Nigel was alongside me and speaking to the hundreds of people there that night, and he was profoundly, profoundly affected by that, because he knew that it could just as easily have been him who was in trouble as Gerald McClellan. In fact, the pair of them were both badly affected by that fight. It was not just McClellan. Ben also was close to losing his license as a result of that fight. So he was allowed to box on, but it was touch and go whether or not he was going to be allowed to box after that because of the damage that McClellan had inflicted on him. But Nigel's had to live with that for the rest of his life. And as you rightly say, if you talk to Nigel Benn about that night against Gerald McClellan, despite all the bad feeling and the bad blood in the run-up to it, he is still hugely, profoundly affected by what happened there and will be for the rest of his life.
To me, that fight was more savage than boxing should ever be, and that's quite a statement to make. It was a bit like the Thriller in Manila, like that. It was just absolutely brutal. You became uncomfortable watching it. I mean, it was such obviously a brilliant fight, but you felt like a border had been crossed. I mean, Ben's knocked out of the ring in the very first round, and you know, some bad things have been said by McClellan in the build up to the fight, which probably didn't help the whole cocktail. But, you know, he was regarded as one of the pound for pound best fighters in the world, wasn't he, McClellan, at that point? Big favorite. I remember Nigel always used to say, "I'm never going to lose to an American," and I don't think he did. You know, it was extraordinary what he did that night. Just in pure boxing terms, you can't really set aside the tragedy, but what he did in boxing terms, in terms of coming back from a bad place in the fight to prevail, was just extraordinary. I mean, just showed what his fighting heart and ability. But you know, McClellan, you know, partially blind, isn't he now? Still in a wheelchair. It's terrible. You know, it's the worst of boxing, all of that. But, you know, I don't know what the referee was supposed to do that night. It was, you were thinking, this is kind of has got to stop. But who did you stop?
Well, it was funny. Go on, John.
It encapsulated the best and the worst that boxing can be. I can remember the following morning thinking precisely that. You know, that was... The atmosphere was as savage and intimidating as any atmosphere I've ever known. The fight itself was as dramatic as anything I'd known. You know, Ben had a long count early on. Danny Mancini did a fantastic job in the corner, revving him up and persuading him, convincing him that he could still win. And then turning the fight around, winning it and stopping McClellan. But then the horrible aftermath, which was the worst thing that boxing can produce, and it was the sort of fight and fought at the sort of intensity, it was the sort of fight which makes you question whether or not this really is a sport and whether or not you really want to be involved in it.
Yeah, that's right. I think, you know, and just going back and talking about this subject, Michael Watson and what happened to him that night, I think originally they went to the wrong hospital, The measures that the British Boxing Border Control brought in after what happened to Watson really helped, I think, to save other people's lives. That, you know, notably, you remember Spencer Oliver, you know, he was in a bad way in the ring and the blood clot, and the protocols worked so well. They got everything right, you know, immobilized him, got him quickly to hospital, oxygen, the whole thing. And I don't know all the medical mechanics of how you deal with this, but, you know, Spencer was as near as right as rain about 3 weeks later. They've developed things well. I mean, but it always will be dangerous. But, you know, that was brutal and savage beyond words, Ben McClellan. Yeah. So I can't kind of count it as a great fight for that reason, because it just almost made me squirm at times watching it, thinking this can't go on like this. This is kind of borderline horrific.
Well, it's interesting that you talk about it like that, because I interviewed Conor Benn recently, and we've talked about Ben and McClellan a couple of times, and he's really interesting on it. And I said, I was asking about his father's great fights, and I said, you know, would you put that up there with one of the great fights? And he said, well, let's put it this way. If that was me in that ring and that had happened to me, I wouldn't want anyone to be calling it a great fight.
Mm, yeah. I mean, he wrote the very good book about it, didn't he? Kevin Mitchell, War Baby. The whole thing, which was a terrific read. I remember Nigel telling me later, one of the interviews I did with him, he said, I was hurting so much and in so much pain when I went home that night that I stayed in the bath for about 10 hours. 10 hours.
So let's change back and go to the rematch of Ben and Eubank. And I remember there's obviously famous pictures of them on the pitch in Old Trafford. And I think Chris had the Harley Davidson, didn't he, in the open leather jacket and that kind of stuff, doing what Eubank did, obviously, John. Did the rivalry was just intense second time around, despite the sportsmanship the first time around, right?
It was intense, and it sold massively to the public, didn't they? There were over 40,000 people at Old Trafford, which was huge. So it was a big sell, but I don't remember quite the level of animosity between the two of them. I think Eubank was Eubank. I think it was Nigel who was the more psyched up second time around, because he saw it as the opportunity to put things right, to show people what he could really do. And to a large extent in that fight, I think he did so, because a lot of people I remember after the fight thought that Eubank had been very, very fortunate to get a draw. And I think the bulk of sort of informed opinion, if you like, thought that Ben should have deserved to get the verdict. It wound up as a draw, but Ben really acquitted himself very well indeed that night, although the fight itself was nothing like as intense as their first meeting.
No, it wasn't. I think, you know, they were older and wiser, and they'd been to that bad, painful place in the first fight. They both knew what the other could do, and I think the shackles were on a little bit. I agree with John. I think Ben won the fight, really, didn't get it. I mean, Eubank was, let's be honest about it, he was the beneficiary of one or two decisions, I think, along the way. You know, but what a sell it was. 42,000 people at Old Trafford. I think it was out. They said the worldwide TV audience for it was something like 500 million. So the names were still up in lights, but it wasn't anywhere near the first fight between them. I suppose, you know, a draw was an honourable way out. There was talk of having a third fight beyond that, but that never came to pass. But it looks like we might be seeing their sons continue rivalry.
Ian, let me ask you this. So obviously John had said that the first atmosphere in Birmingham was a bear pit. What did we get in the second one at Old Trafford? A crackling atmosphere nonetheless?
Yeah, I should tell you at this point, John Rawling had replaced me as the BBC radio boxing commentator. And I was, so the roles were switched. I was presenting the program and John was the commentator, because I'd gone off to do a little bit of TV at this point. So John, it was John's domain to be the commentator, but we were still great mates and had a great laugh and covering it. I don't think the atmosphere was quite as intense as I remember it. I mean, 42,000 at Old Trafford, it had kind of drawn a crowd beyond boxing. You know, there are a lot of, you know, but that crossover appeal. Some of them were like maybe Manchester United football fans who had season tickets. I don't know how it worked. But no, I just don't think the whole thing was anywhere near that first fight when they were young bucks.
Do you remember the press conference afterwards when we went up and Eubank was sort of addressing the throng of reporters, and one of the reporters, I better not mention his name, but he was shouting, "It's a joke, it's a joke, Ben won, it's a joke, it's a joke." And Eubank looks at this guy and he said, again, I won't give his name, he said, "Excuse me, are you intoxicated?"
Do you remember that? Yeah.
I could hardly speak. I'd got tears rolling down my cheeks.
He was funny. I remember another one when he fought a guy called Dan Shomer in South Africa.
Oh, my God, yeah. That was awful. Was
terrible that night. He hardly did a thing in the fight. He got the decision somehow.
God knows how.
Shomer was just a sort of not much more than a journeyman. So we're singing on the ring apron afterwards, waiting to do the interview with Eubank. And we, for some reason, we had to wait for the satellite. There was some problem with the satellite. And I said, "Chris," I said, "can you just wait 5 minutes?" I said, "Chris, we've got a problem with the satellite." He said, "Yes, of course, Mr. Dark." And then suddenly there was a silence. And he goes, "How did you score the fight?" And I said, "Want a diplomatic answer or a real one, Chris?" He goes, "No, tell me what you thought." And I said, "Thought you lost it, but I said you just didn't do enough." I think you lost it by a point or two on our scorecard. But you know, hey, look, they've given you it. And he turned to Barry Hearn. He went, "We shall need to look at the tape of this." So we can't do the interview. Of course, he says, you know, he thought he did enough and all that thing. 3 weeks later, I'm out shopping in Kingston-on-Thames doing my Christmas shopping. And the phone rings and he goes, is this Mr. Dark? I said, yes, yes. It's Chris Eubank. I thought it was John Rawling or somebody who does Christmas wind-up as they were wont to. It was him. And he goes, I've reviewed the tape of the fight. You remember you said you scored it. I a point or two to show, man. He said, in my estimation, you were correct in your assessment.
Wow.
I love that. Please don't tell anybody. Have a happy Christmas.
They changed their whole, the board changed their rules about making weight after that fight, if you remember, because Eubank had crashed his weight. We were there in Africa at Sun City, which can be pretty warm, and it was seriously warm when we were over there. And Chris, for a week beforehand, didn't eat and didn't drink to make weight. And the board reassessed their rules as a result of this, and they brought in check weights to make sure that people weren't doing this. But I remember clearly sitting by the pool side at this fabulous hotel where we were staying, and Eubank was there, and we were just sort of chatting idly, just whiling away a bit of time. And I'd ordered a bottle of mineral water, as you do. And I said, "So, Chris, do you want one? Do you want to drink?" He said. He looked at me. He said, "Are you insane? Are you insane? You know, it's the middle of the day in searing heat." And he wasn't taking on any liquid whatsoever so that he could somehow make the weight to fight this guy who nobody had ever heard of called Dan Shomer. And he was, you talk about dead at the weight. He must have been absolutely running on empty that night.
I think he did that a few times, didn't he? Crash dieted to make the weight. So that wasn't so professional. And in fact, it was a bit dangerous, wasn't it?
A bit.
Yeah, of course. But it was interesting, obviously, you both mentioned the Aston Martin earlier. Obviously, Ben was a Porsche guy, wasn't he? He had his Porsche 911, and then later on, years down the line, Eubank trumped everyone and bought a giant Peterbilt truck, didn't he? Which he would cavort down and up and down Brighton seafront in. Were either of you fortunate enough to take a ride in a Peterbilt truck?
No, I never went in it. I was. I'm not a truck kind of guy. I wouldn't have minded a ride in the Aston Martin, though. That was a serious piece of kit.
Yeah, well, only the Vagrant got a ride in that.
Yeah, you couldn't pass for one of them, John.
Dorchester, apparently. So, yeah. But Nigel, we mentioned Nigel and a somewhat kind of difficult relationship with the media. But he did used to come up with great quotes. I remember him saying once in one of the interviews, he goes, "Sometimes I feel like I've got the angel on one shoulder and the devil on the other one." You know, it's sort of like this sort of great insights. And, you know, and another time he said to me, and this was after McClellan in one of the interviews, and it was getting towards the end of his career. You know, I think he had those two fights, Collins, didn't he, right at the end. And he said to me, "Do you know something?" He said, "I think about it, and I think in the end, I'm going to have to have this business bashed out of me," which is a frightening quote. "I'm going to have this business bashed out of me." So, you know, he's okay, isn't he? Now, though, you know, he's in Australia and does a lot of good work, and I think he's financially, you know, he's been well looked after. So great.
Yeah, sorry, John.
We look back at the pair of them, don't we, with admiration. It was a great time. Nigel was an outstanding fighter. I mean, he might not have been the greatest boxer, but my God, he used to bring some excitement to the ring. And I look back at his time, and you didn't have too many dull Nigel Benn fights, did you? He was a very, very exciting fighter. And Eubank as well, this fantastic rivalry. When you look back at that, it's one of the great rivalries in the history of British boxing. There's not one really which I think stands out as anything superior to that.
Nigel had a bit of ego about him, I remember too, because we ran one of those Judgment Day pay-per-view Sky Sports nights, and the promo was all about Bruno. He was on the same bill as Bruno, and there wasn't very much about Ben, who thought he should have had equal billing. So when we went out to Tenerife to do the interviews with him, when we walked in the gym, he said, "No, Get out, Scott. I don't want you anywhere near. Go away. So we spent 3 days kind of negotiating with him by phone via the sort of people in London as well to see if he would relent. And eventually we talked him round, and they had to change the promo that they were putting out on Sky for the fight. So that it, you know, there was more about Ben in it. I said, look, not getting any cooperation. I said he's got a bit of a point. I'd watch this promo, but he's got a bit of a point. It is like, you know, he's being treated sort of as if he's some undercard fighter from somewhere. I said, he is Nigel Benn, who's done everything he did. So they did change the promo, and then we went and did the interview, and he was like just tremendous fun. Like, we'd had this big row, but he'd completely forgotten that, and he did one of the best interviews we ever did with him. After that, he said, I've been a pain in the backside, haven't I? I said, yeah, I have a bit, yeah, but let's get on with it.
John, let me put this to you. So Ian obviously referenced the boys fighting, so Connor and Chris Jr. fighting to pick up the rivalry some 30 years on. I think it's going to be very close to the anniversary of one of the fights, actually, I think, should they meet in this suggested October date. But can you imagine this, John, them, the kids together, and then Eubank Senior and Ben Senior all at the dais together for a press conference?
Mm-hmm. Well, if it happens, it's going to be magic, isn't it? Because it brings back all those memories, and it's a decent fight in its own right. I personally think that Chris Eubank Jr. is too big for Nigel, for Nigel's lad, for Connor, and I think that I would certainly lean that way. But the press conference would be fantastic. It makes you want to be there with a microphone, with a notepad, being a part of it, because you can guarantee there'll be some terrific lines there.
Yeah, I mean, it's the easiest sell ever, isn't it? What it's, I mean, it's nostalgia hour. You know, everybody can rerun the tapes of the Ben Eubank fights, and yeah, they can. You could build a lot of programming around that. You could fill a week of programs with Ben Eubank nostalgia.
Yeah, and I think nostalgia is the key word, because a lot of people are looking for that in their content in this day and age, whether you look at Netflix or Sky or whatever. You know, people do like that nostalgic stuff. Obviously, Sky have recently invested in that Bruno Tyson documentary to go back over the old times and the old feelings that people get from that. But I think the Eubank and Ben thing is interesting. When John talks about some lines, there's probably some pre-rehearsed lines in there, because let's not forget as well, Eubank and Ben have been doing speaking engagements together the last couple of years, or either side of COVID, where they're going out and doing after dinner speaking together, which is phenomenal. When you guys talk about the grudge and the feud, and particularly the Ben feud, and do you remember that they did that gladiator thing years on?
Yeah.
Where they actually fell out on set, didn't they? And they couldn't finish the show.
I know Eubank, in those speeches, he's gone, he sometimes is there, Nigel's sometimes late as ever, and Eubank starts it on his own. And one of the quotes which came out, which I think was written about in a big article in the Daily Mail, he said that somebody asked him about whether or not he still hated Nigel Benn. And he said, the reason I won that first fight was because Nigel hated me. I just regarded it as a fight, and I was just trying to prove I was the better man. He let emotion take him over. And he said, but fast forward to now, he said, I don't hate Nigel Benn. In fact, I love Nigel Benn, because without Nigel Benn, I wouldn't be Chris Eubank.
Well, there we are. You know, it's like, I mean, Ali Frazier never did make up, did they? You know, going back. But I think it's great the way that sometimes people who are bitter sporting rivals kind of become a little bit matey later in life, because they know they shared something together. You know, you think of Ben, you think of Eubank, you think of Eubank, you think of Ben. They kind of help to make each other as big as they both were. And, you know, there's, let's be blunt about it, there's money to be made out of that as well in later life. It's a bit like Steve Ovett and Sebastian Coe in the Athletics, who became, you know, they were bitter rivals on the track, and you know, swap gold medals, if you like, won each other's event in Moscow, but became mates in later life. So, you know, you wouldn't say Ben and Eubank are exactly mates, but, you know, I think they understand how they're part of a very big sporting narrative for the ages.
Yeah, and I think that's a good way to leave it, gents. It's been brilliant and super insightful. I'm sure we'll do a lot more on Ben and Eubank, maybe separately or maybe some of their other big fights. But it's great to talk about their relationship over the years and how it's sort of evolved and everything else. And another good sporting rivalry where they've put their grudge to one side was no one ever thought Barrera and Morales would be pally, but now they're going out to dinner with their wives, which is incredible. So gents, we're we're all still mad. Well, you say that, John's just hopped off the Zoom, but anyway, but no, John's there. All right, guys. Well, look, this has been a lot of fun, and we'll be back on Ringside Rewind soon.
Hi, I'm John Rawling, welcoming you to Ringside Rewind, where I'm joined by Tris Dixon and Ian Dark. And we're grateful for the sponsorship from Fleet UK, a car and commercial vehicle leasing company based in Hampshire who are supporting our podcast. Great people who've supplied customers for 20 years or more, including me. Wherever you are, they'll find and supply any vehicle you want and work out financing options to best suit your needs. Fleet UK pride themselves on transparency, trust and fairness in every deal, and you can take it from me, they are brilliant at what they do. Check them out at fleetuk.com.